our main guest today, Tim Stafford. Of course, you know Tim from Blue Highway. He has a more recent solo album out, Just to Hear a Whistle Blow, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Blue Highway, a lot of neat stuff. Well, I'm really happy to welcome a favorite guitar player of mine to Unreal Bluegrass, and I'm going to tell him the first time I saw him, he'll remember it. It was kind of a cool day. But Tim Stafford, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing great. First of all, Tim is on. We're going to talk about the most recent solo album, Just to Hear the Whistle Blow, which is great. And, of course, Tim is part of, has to be. I was thinking about this over the weekend. As far as the band and the band members staying together, certainly band names stay and great people come and go, but as far as Blue Highway staying together as long as it's been, is there a band that's been that consistently as far as the membership of a band and producing at such a great level? I was trying to think of inside the bluegrass realm where that ever happened before.
Yeah, I don't know that there's been another band stay together 20 years with the same personnel, although, I mean, we had one personnel change where Jason left the band for a couple of years.
Right.
And Tom Adams played with us and recorded one album with us.
I remember
that. But then Jason came back, and so we had the original guys.
Yeah.
I think that's probably pretty unprecedented.
It is. I mean, if you think of it, I knew when I saw you when Tom was with you once, and of course I knew about the change in that, but really as far as the basic band, I mean, even the Rolling Stones have members change.
Yeah, I like them mentioned in the same breath of those guys.
I will tell you, Tim, the first time I saw you, and this you got to go back a little bit, Ricky Skaggs was making his comeback to bluegrass. And Ricky Skaggs put together a show that he called the Ricky Skaggs Pickin' Party.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the places he hit was right near me, and I'm in northern Kentucky, and he hit Cincinnati. And, of course, when it was Ricky, he had the big Kentucky Thunder thing, and then he went back to the small bluegrass group. On the bill was the first time that the New South with J.D. from that famous album appeared on stage, Tony and Ricky and everybody. First time that ever happened, Jerry Douglas. The opening band, though, was Alison Krauss and Union Station.
I remember it well. I believe that was at River Bend.
It was at River Bend, yeah.
And, Ricky did a series of those. I know that we played Wolf Trap around D.C., and we also did a show in Baltimore, and we did a couple of others with him over the years with that. I think we actually did a few with Blue Highway. He continued doing those different parties.
Oh, yeah, okay. So that was you and Adam Steffi. I'm just going from the picture in my head. You, Adam Steffi, Barry Bales, Allison Brown on banjo.
Right.
Right, and then Allison Krauss. And that's the first time I'd ever heard her sing or play or do anything. I think I knew of Allison Brown because I'm just kind of a banjo guy. But that was the first time I saw you, and that was a great band. I mean, obviously, everybody's going on to do great stuff from there, but I'm just thinking my time on that was early 90s, maybe 91, 90. I saw the T-shirt somewhere.
Yeah, that was around 90 or 91. Yeah. I was with her from 90 to 92. I think it was May of that year, June. Just spend more time with my son.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He was just born. He was born in January of 92. He's now 22, so...
There you go. That adds up. I want to talk to you about... This is the thing that's always fascinating to me, and I have your other solo album from, like, what's it, 04, 05?
Endless Line was in 04.
Yeah. Something that's always curious to me is, number one, how you select tunes to put on an album, but also when I think in terms of Tim Stafford and your long association with the, you know, just an award-winning year after year after year, Blue Highway... What is it that makes you decide that this is the time to put out something under my name as Tim Stafford, Just to Hear the Whistle Blow? What comes together that make it the right timing for you?
It's just a combination of factors. I think part of it is the amount of material that I have that I feel pretty good about that hasn't been recorded by other people, you know. And I had quite a few cuts this year. And that last year also, and Blue Highway put a record out. Of course, The Game came out in January, and I
had four
songs or something like that on that. But, you know, I got to looking around, and I still had a lot of stuff, and I had a lot of instrumentals. I've got so many instrumentals I've written, and I don't have an outlet for them, you know. And I've actually got a couple other albums planned that just guitar stuff because I just got too much stuff, you know, and I want to try to get it out there before it gets stale in my mind, and you know, can still maybe put together a good group. Or I thought about even doing a solo guitar record, but I'm not sure if that would work. But anyway, it's a you know, combination of that and just the timing. Blue Highway's record, I was wanting to do this last year, and it got delayed, and then, you know, I didn't want to compete with the Blue Highway record,
right.
So I waited, you know, 7 months or so, six, 7 months after it was out, and I didn't know that Sean was doing a record, too, and of course, I didn't know Rob was planning on doing a record with Trey Hansley.
Trey, that's right,
out.
Yeah.
And he's also got one... Three Bells record with Jerry Douglas and Mike Aldridge, you know.
Right. So. Wow, that's a great piece. Yeah. Well, you know, but so you kind of reach this point where you write so many tunes and songs, and you do write I think about as much as anybody as I look through all the stuff that you've written yourself, not just instrumentals but also songs and whatnot. But at some point you just decide that it's time to peel off and do some things the way you could. Not all of these things would automatically fit into a Blue Highway setting. I'm not saying they're so divergent, but there's sort of like a bluesy tune on here, which is really cool. I don't think that they would play, maybe they would play Hideaway Hotel, I don't know.
Probably not.
Yeah.
And that's one reason for doing a song like that on this record, for sure. You know, you want to try to do things that maybe the band wouldn't do, just stretch out a little bit.
Yeah. I will tell you that currently, and I've been listening... And I get ready for one of these. If it's a newer thing to me, I listen, and it's just, you know, nonstop replay. And I will tell you that currently, as I'm sitting here talking to you, Dimes is my favorite song on the album for right now. But I will tell you that in about a week, I think it's going to become Hideaway Hotel. And I, for no particular reason, it just starts getting stuck in your head. I mean, Dimes is just, gosh, it's a great lyric and a great story and everything. But then the hotel song, I'm thinking, you know, you're writing it as a hotel.
Yeah, that was Steve Gulley and I just trying to figure out a way to tell this story without narrating it. Have a person narrate it. It just wouldn't be near as effective, you know. And when we start throwing out lines with the hotel actually telling its own story, and we laughed and we thought, hey, it's not worked, you know. And
of course,
when we got into it, it seemed like it worked.
Well, I assume you had to heavily research it because you've probably never actually seen the slot where you got to put the razor blade in and all that stuff.
Actually, I have. I hate to admit, man, you know, I mean, over the years in bluegrass music, you end up staying places. don't cost a lot of money.
I know.
I have seen this razor blade. I don't think Steve knew what I was talking about.
Do you ever wonder where all the razor blades went, by the way? I was always curious about that.
Yeah, I did too. Is there some kind of, you know, central razor blade depository or something? I don't know.
It's a great song, and there's so many people that, of course, it's not a solo guitar album. By the way, let me ask you this. You also did a lot of instructional material through different, and it's probably still available out there, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dan Miller wanted me to do a thing a few years ago. Oh, gosh, when was this? It ended up being 15 years ago now. And you can tell because I've got a mullet in the picture on the cover. So. and he really, he had seen me do a few camps, you know, teach at a few camps.
Right.
And I did a thing at that time. I must still do it, really, is about the basics and the fundamentals and how important they are, the T's, timing, tuning, taste, tone, and technique. And he wanted me to do a video based on that, and so we did, and that is still available. It's called Acoustic Guitar Fundamentals,
mm-hmm.
and it's It's on FGM or Highview. That's Dan Miller. You can find that online. I believe at flatpick.com, and I actually have it for sale through my website.
Okay.
StaffordGuitar.com. And John Wallace, who now is the co-owner of Bluegrass Today.
Right, Accutab.
Yeah, he used to have a company called Accutab that they still, I don't think they produce many videos and tab books, but they still manufacture them, you know. Not so much more of the tab books. It seems like with the advent of YouTube and all that, that's really kind of taken the steam out of that movement. But at one time, you know, tab books were really a big thing, and he did a tab book for my the first three Blue Highway records, and Every Time You Say Goodbye with Alice, and a couple other albums that I played on, Butch Baldassare's Old Town. And
oh, yeah, Butch.
This would have been like the, you know, 96, 97, somewhere in there. And, you know, that I'm not sure if that's even still available. I know I do have a few copies for sale, and I do have through my website, but I'm not sure if John still has them.
Your website is timstaffordguitar.com.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and you can also order the CDs and all that from there.
Yeah. The on the new album, the newer album, Just to Hear the Whistle Blow. First of all, that's a great song. The title cut alone is a great song. And is it? I mean, there's a lot of train songs, granted, but you know, it's still a real fertile area because of it has to do with the journey. It represents the journey, and you know, I mean, you can never. But it's just a nice a little story that you tell.
Sort of our Steve Gulley and I's way. We had this title. I believe I had the title, and I thought, gosh, you know, it just sounds like somebody who wishes they had hopped a freight train, you know, and never did. And that's really what we ended up doing. And that way, we felt like we could make it a little more unique for a train song. But you're right; they are still a big part of the bluegrass departures and power and a bygone way of transportation of life, and they represent a lot of things. I think there's no, you know, Bluegrass Junction. I think it's named that for a reason, you know.
Yeah, well, you'd almost hope that the history behind trains in general doesn't become, you know, so drop out of our memory so much that they still do have a place in that yearning to go somewhere else, or the ability to hop a train, let's say. I wouldn't do it because I would be cut in half. I'm sure I'd miss it. But, I mean, you know, the whole thing, the city of New Orleans. I mean, think about that whole theory. That's a perfect, and it's a great tune. You obviously write a lot of songs with Steve Gulley, which is a good thing for both of you. But this is something I ask every person that writes songs about, the process of writing. Everybody has a different approach. Sometimes it's very informal. Sometimes it's like, let's go have a session and sit. But how do you approach things with someone like Steve Gulley? Obviously, you write a lot of songs with him and know him very well. How would you think about coming to a song?
We almost always have the same way that we approach it, and it's very informal. We get together, and the first thing we do is catch up, you know, because we probably haven't seen each other in a few months. And sometimes in the process of catching up, we'll come up with ideas for songs. And but eventually we will start throwing out ideas. You know, I'll have a book. I keep ideas on my phone on a file in a program called ColorNote.
Okay.
And I'm always looking for ideas everywhere. And I think that's one of the most important things as writers, to be open to that. You know, you can find them on Facebook. You can find them in a newspaper. You can overhear it at a restaurant. You can see it on a sign. I've written three songs, I think it is, on signs. Just signs either in front of churches.
Okay.
You know, billboards, believe it or not, you know, advertising slogans. Just sayings, things that people say, you know. And you got to be attuned to that and be willing to write it down, because if you don't, you'll forget it. You think you won't, but you really will.
So you keep a file on your computer, but obviously if you're out somewhere and you don't have do you just take notes? Do you write notes in a little notebook?
I did have a notebook, but I have my phone with me almost everywhere I go.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. There you go. Easy enough.
I have a little app on my phone that I keep them in. And it automatically backs it up, you know, to the cloud. And but then we pick an idea. We might throw out about 7 or 8 ideas, and one or two we'll come back and say, you know, the best thing I've heard is this. You know, let's work on that. Cool. So then we just kind of start fleshing out what that title means and maybe the approach we want to take. And pretty soon, you know, Steve will be pacing. And if Steve gets up and starts pacing, I know we're getting ready to have some good ideas. And he's really good at fleshing out the scenario or the story of the thing. He says, okay, well, this guy's probably this and da-da-da. And, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. While he's doing that, I'm writing down what he's saying. And I'm maybe coming up with lines at this point. And although we both contributed melody, I'm mainly the guy, I think, who does most of the melodies. And what I do when I pick up the guitar, which is usually after we've already written quite a bit, is I'm trying to match what we've written with a melody. And I think that's the key to a good song is to make that lyrics, you know. And to me, if I see a story on the page, it automatically kicks something in me that says, really? Okay, that sounds like this. You know, and I'm able to come up with a melody fairly easy.
When you have a lyric then in front of you, does it strike you that does the tempo also strike you at the same time that the melody that you're coming up with, or how is it just from the story?
Okay. Sometimes the tempo is dictated by the subject matter.
I mean, obviously, Dimes is not going to work as an up-tempo number.
No, yeah. And you know that going in. And, you know, Dimes was actually just, I had this story. It's actually a true story. And about a fellow who finds Dimes after his father, who also found Dimes, is like a family joke.
Mm-hmm.
And after he passes away, the son finds him.
Yeah.
And it's a spooky thing. Actually, I think a lot of people don't understand exactly what happens in that song, but it's actually almost a supernatural thing. And it seemed to me to sound more like kind of like a James Taylor sort of thing.
Exactly. Yep.
And so that's the melody that sort of ended up happening.
You know, it's funny. I didn't know until recently, and the saying "Pennies from Heaven." I didn't know that there actually people believe that when someone passes away that you find a penny, it's them, you know, the pennies are coming from heaven from someone who's recently passed. I had no idea that's what that meant. I always connected it to a song, you know, every time it rains penny. I had no idea. So when I hear Dimes, it reminds me of that same idea that it's kind of like this connection to, in this case, the guy's father is passed on, and it's the same thing. He finds a dime, and you know, I've heard the song you wrote it, but I mean, it's a great story that makes that same type of family connection. And it is kind of like a supernatural thing that here's a dime from Pop, I guess, is if you want to boil it down to that.
Right. Now, that was the idea. I saw one reviewer, I don't think he got that, and I thought, well, maybe I didn't do a good enough job.
No, it's right there. It makes perfect. It's a beautiful story. I have a question. Oh, yeah, sure. I have a question for you, too. Now, you were on, when Larry Sparks did that 40th album, there's a classic, and I'll tell you why I'm bringing this up. Carter's Blues, you're on there with Larry and Kenny Smith, and gosh, I'm not blowing the other one, but Carter's Blues,
Jim Hurst.
Vince Gill. Yeah. So that's, why do tunes like, and that's a great, it's the greatest combination of runs from great guitar players, because I think Larry is one of the best. You know, he's the BB King of bluegrass players. He's got the one note and just the perfect tone and intonation. You know, the vibration, and he's proud of that.
He's like the BB King and the Aretha Franklin of bluegrass music.
That's right. There you go. That's better.
Yeah, that's how he just sets so much soul in his.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I'm a huge fan of his, and when they asked, Don Risley produced that record, and he asked me to be on it, I said, are you kidding us? When and where? You
know? So Carter's Blues, song goes forever and ever. I don't know where it comes, but it's old. And then on your new album, you do Red Wing, which is, again, an old, you know, everybody that picks up a guitar, you're going to play a two-chord song you're going to learn to play Red Wing, not like you do, but what? So Red Wing pops back up in your repertoire on this new album, and I'm always interested in you writing new stuff, and it's very different, and the Hideaway Hotel is a whole different. It is kind of like a bluesy story, but then you go back and you put Red Wing on there because there's something back in that tune that's still compelling you to put it back on a record.
Yeah, I always love the tune. And the thing, I guess, really that caused me to want to put it on there is that it I wanted to do something in a D position capoed up, a drop D. And what I ended up doing is recording the tune in G, but I capoed, I used two capos. I used one at the third fret. The guitar techs, you know, people who really know guitar stuff, they'll know what I'm talking about. So they capo at the third fret with a standard page type capo, and then at the fifth fret, capo over the first five strings with Kaiser capo.
Sure.
So I only take, you know, and that way I have a built-in drop D with that retuning, and it's very high pitch. So it's kind of reminiscent of Carter Family. It's not that style at all, but it's in that same, it's pitched in the same area where Mabel played a lot of things.
Gotcha.
Did.
Yeah.
And then, kind of, it seems to me like it was just, I loved it out of D position on the guitar, but I didn't want to play it in D. So I wanted it somewhere where a banjo could play it and the fiddle would take a great, really cool break on it.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, and it's like one of those tunes that most people recognize whether they know the name of it or not. But it's still fresh when you bring it back to the way you're describing. I understand what you're saying about that. And I will tell you this: the people that listen to this show are pretty clever and pretty smart about music, because they have a lot of musicians on, and they get the mental image of how you're describing that you got to that tuning.
Sure.
So it tickles me that, you know, all these neat new songs and all this, but those things are still worthy of, you know, when Tim Stafford wants to make a solo album for the reasons you described. Red Wing comes back into it. And I would love to understand how those melodies persist.
Yeah, the thing about Red Wing, and it's true of a lot of these instrumentals that people play, that most people don't realize there's actually words to it. There's lyrics, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And to me, it sounds like a singing. You know, that it's one of those instrumentals that I can almost hear the words, you know, when you play it. And not all instrumentals are like that.
No.
You can tell on a lot of Bill Monroe's later instrumentals that, you know, that's strictly instrumental wizardry, and it's not really I couldn't imagine a lyric being set to some of those things like Old Dangerfield. I guess you could, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can almost hear the words on Red Wing.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's kind of a classic tune, you know. I just like the way it laid in D position on the guitar.
So. Yeah, it's a great. I'm glad to see it recorded again in this year. I mean, it's just one of those tunes that, like you said, it is. It's something we used to sing in choir when I was a kid. So I know the words to it. I'm not going to sing them for you, but I do what you're saying, that there's words to it. People think it's just like, oh, it's Red Wing. It's a fiddle tune or a guitar. Actually, it's a song, you know.
Right.
You know, and they always said that Earl was always playing the words when Earl Scruggs played the banjo. So I guess when you have a lyric like that in your head, it does kind of help you shape the solos that you're going to take, because you're always thinking of those words in your head.
Yeah. I always thought it was fascinating. I know John Harper always told this story about Earl actually playing his breaks different. You know, his second break would be different from the first, and somebody asked him why he did that, and he said, well, there's different words. I'm trying to play the words.
That's right. That's right. That's just a neat little thing that it still works so well. And of course, you got to have the chops to pull it off. But when you explain Red Wing, I wanted to ask you specifically, and there's a lot of great songs that you put together on this album, but that one just stuck out. And I said, there's old Red Wing again, hanging out and still sounding fresh under Tim's hand. So it works really well. The Isaac Morton's Revenge, I have a few questions, and then you can talk about whatever you want, but I want to know about when you talk about stories.
Well, yeah, Isaac Morton was actually one that I started myself, and it just laid there for years. It was half finished, and one time when Steve and I got together, I said, well, here's one I started, and I never was able to finish. I thought we could through pretty quick, and it took us a little while, but we were able to finish it, and it turns into like an epic poem almost. Mm-hmm. But it's just a tale of revenge and a guy following another one to the end of the earth just to get his revenge, I kind of like tunes like that. I've always loved Hot Rods, and I love Tim O'Brien singing, and I felt like it was when he might have died at some point.
Hey, tell me, Tim, who is, let the listeners know who's joining on this thing for some of the vocals first.
Well, I'm singing that one and several others on the record, but I got Marty Rabin sings Worries Like a Rocking Chair.
That's clearly Marty Rabin.
Yeah, I love Marty. You know, I just heard him singing that when Barry Bales and I wrote that tune. And as soon as we finished it, I thought, man, I think I even told Barry. You know, I could just hear Marty singing that. And luckily, he agreed to do it. Mm-hmm. And then Beth Snap, who's a local singer here in the Tri-Cities area of East Tennessee, and from Gray Station, she's just a phenomenal singer, and she has an album out herself, actually. It's not bluegrass at all. She's kind of reminds me a lot of Norah Jones.
Okay.
And she's a great solo guitar player and writer. Writes her own stuff, and it's very much in her own style. And, I've gotten to know Beth real well. She's one of the people that hangs out with Bobby Sarnes and Bobby's studio, which is that's where I recorded this record.
And, yeah.
And when we started thinking about people that actually sing that song, I thought of her first. So, I like having guest vocalists, and I had John Callen come in and sing one on my first record, and I had a few other guest vocalists. But the core band is Adam Steffi and Ron Stewart. Ron played fiddle and banjo on a few tunes, like Isaac Morton's Revenge.
Yeah.
But the main fiddling throughout is Stuart Duncan, and that's somebody he had said he would play on my first record, and we couldn't get the schedule. And Jim Van Cleve did a great job on my first record. But so Stuart's playing fiddle on this, and Barry Bales plays bass, and Steve Gulley comes in and sings harmony.
Yeah. Good group. When you talked about Ron Stewart playing fiddle and banjo, you notice how I didn't go wow, because it's so incredible that I'm waiting for him. Here's the wow moment for me and Ronnie Stewart if he plays them both at the same time. Then he will impress me on a new level.
That would be a wow moment.
That would be a wow moment because he does everything. So he's like a banjo, guitar. Yeah, I mean, so and they're all like his first instrument that he's ever touched since childhood. So I didn't overreact, but I didn't want to let you know that I wasn't interested in the fact that Ron was playing both, because I still think, okay, now, bud, you've been doing that long enough, playing both at the same time. Then
you're, yeah, anybody could do it. He probably could.
He probably does it, and just won't do it in public.
Yeah, he's amazing. He played on my first record too, and I just love his playing, and wanted to get him. And I played on a lot of records with him and Adam. The three of us played on a lot of records together.
Yeah.
And seems like that was just a natural choice. And then of course Adam only lives like 15 minutes away from the studio where I did all this.
Okay.
Barry was about 45 minutes away, so. Not only did I grow up playing with those guys, but it just made sense to get them